globally and in the South in particular. And I think one of the main problems, over and above the good things in it, which I'll get back to in a second, is the politics behind the book. The politics behind the book is that spontaneity is how the working class will come to power. And that belief that classes don't have to be formed, developed, working class capacities have to be developed, that this can happen spontaneously, that militancy is seen as synonymous with the development of class, is a problem that I think runs through the book in every dimension. I just want to say that to start with. What's good about the book is what people have raised. It's great that he's actually saying the question of the proletariat defined broadly is important. It's crucial. He's saying this is relevant. What's happening throughout the world is going to depend very much on what happens, what these people do and what they do not. That's important. The importance of bringing the South into this conversation, mm-hmm. not just as victims, but actually saying, look, there's examples of potential and dynamism there, and we should be studying it, is very important. The emphasis on migration is critical, not just migration into the North, but migration within the South, mm-hmm. migration into South Africa from the rest of the continent, mm-hmm. obviously migration across China. These are really critical questions to ask when we're thinking about class formation. And it's useful to start throwing out these case studies. Let's actually take a look at specific struggles and ask what their implications are, what do we learn from their creativity, etc. The problem with this is, I think it's very under-theorized. And I don't think it's a question of getting into a lot of heavy theory, but you know, there's the problem that Viviana raised. You know, there isn't a thing called the South. It's incredibly uneven. There isn't a common thing. It's, you know, there's a lot of heterogeneity there, and that has actually increased over time. There's enormous differences between the path of Latin America and China, or Asia, or Africa, or the Middle East. These aren't part of one package. One of the questions that he addresses is, well, how are these working classes actually integrated? What are we talking about in terms of the relationship? And that's where he throws in the notion of imperialism, which is very useful in an emotive kind of a way. And it's obvious when the US is going into Iran or Iraq. But it's not at all clear what he actually means by imperialism. And it's very important to sort that out, because for many, what he's talking about is foreign direct investment. With this foreign direct investment, it's imperialism. Well, that creates all kinds of confusion. If Brazilian corporations are going into the rest of Latin America, is that imperialism? Is China an imperialist country? As one of the key examples he uses from the South. Is South Africa an imperialist country because of its investments through the continent? It raises that kind of confusion. It also creates a larger problem, and Manny kind of gets it at one level, because when you start talking about imperialism and blaming imperialism for oppression, you tend not to look at the balance of class forces inside the country. You tend to skip over them. Now, Manny, in his examples, keeps referring to the state and what domestic business is doing, but it does have that tendency to miss that. But globalization is about, what the making of global capitalism is about, is not just oppression, but actually also integration of classes. And this isn't just about the fact that foreign direct investment is invited in by states or invited in by domestic capital. It's also a question that of it having an impact on the integration of domestic working classes. Mm-hmm. Workers demand investment from foreign capitals in terms of their jobs. And it isn't just in Canada, where you've got negotiations going on, where the major question is, we want more investment for an American multinational. You know, how do you proceed with that? But it's also the case in South Africa, where workers are demanding more investment from Ford. So we have to deal with these, the contradictions, and the fact that there is both oppression and integration, and how do we deal with this? The second thing that I think is important for us, and I think this too gets at something that Viviana raised when she questioned how we think about class, is we need an anthropology of class formation. not just looking at this kind of economic development and what's happening with statistics, because it gets very complicated, because these are classes in the process of being made. So for example, it's important whether migrants see themselves as leaving home temporarily but wanting to go back home, or if they see it as that era of going back home is over. There's nothing to do there anymore, and now we're actually going to become permanent workers. It's also important when we think about, well, what's the unit when we talk about precarious work? If it's the family, then it can be quite different. You could have a full-time worker and an extended family who are doing precarious work. But how do you relate them in terms of class formation when it's in the same unit? Here we have to think about, there's immigration. Well, there's differences between the generations of immigrants. There's the first, when they began to allow Chinese in the mid-60s, rather than just discriminate against them, you have an inflow of Chinese and Asian immigrants who many of them come from middle-class families, but end up being at the bottom of the rung here in terms of what jobs they get. But their kids go to university because there is still a middle-class mentality. And when you look at the average income of Asian families today, it's higher than the income for white families. So we have to think about all these complexities and think about it anthropologically. And when we're thinking about it anthropologically, we have to get over this identification of militancy as automatically telling us something about class formation. We don't know what it means. When Chinese workers who used to work for a state-owned corporation and it's getting privatized, and they get mad because they're losing some of their privileges, what does this mean? Does it mean that they want to retain benefits so they will have them? Mm-hmm. Or does it mean that they remember when there was healthcare for everybody and that's what they want to fight for? And generally, that's not what they've been fighting for. They've generally been fighting for their own interests. What is the relationship between the workers who are coming in from the countryside, and they're very militant and they're ready to go on strike, but their demand is to catch up to what the other workers have? Is there a possibility of them moving in a different direction than the Western working class went in terms of individual consumption versus public spaces and social consumption? In South Africa, I was at a forum when Irvin Jim spoke, the head of NUMSA, and it was in Washington. It was mostly a left forum. He stood up and he made a rousing speech about the vanguard of the proletariat and the revolution and taking over the state, and everybody was excited about this. This is incredible. Here we have a worker who's talking the language of Lenin and of the Russian Revolution, but we really have to think about, well, what does it really mean? Because, in terms of actually trying to change things in South Africa, the first problem he has is not to be isolated. They're trying to build a new federation, which is exciting, but building a new federation is complicated. The miners, the new miners who were super militant, courageously so, amazingly militant, they're very apolitical in other ways. What do you do with this? If you're looking for allies, because you're fighting the state, you're fighting the rest of the trade union movement, you're fighting the ANC, what happens to your radicalism? Maybe not as radical as you. How does that get shaped? How does a union begin to act like a political party? These are really difficult questions that have to be raised. So that gets me, to the main thing that I started with. When you read Manny's book, you think we were winning. We're not winning. That has to kind of be the starting point. And if we recognize that we're not winning, we can have a serious conversation about what we really have to do to think about winning. The examples he gives are inspiring. I think the example of India is particularly interesting because of the attempt to link precarious and traditional workers like the railroad workers in the same unions or in the same labor central. But what you really, to pull off what they just did in that strike, which was just a one-day strike, it wasn't a general strike, it's called a general strike, but it's still a one-day strike. To pull off what is something, they use numbers of 150 to 180 million workers. The unionized workforce in India wouldn't be 40 million. It wouldn't be a quarter of that. How did they get all these people out? Well, you can't get that without institutions, without deep institutions that are rooted everywhere, and that raises all the questions of bureaucracy. And you can't get rid of it by saying we don't need institutions, that will just depend on working class spontaneity. We have to take this question seriously, that there are things that happen to institutions, and how do we ensure that they, in fact, have checks and balances, that they're democratic, that they think in terms of class, not just in terms of their own particular interests. And this is critical. If we're going to look at these examples and be serious about it, we have to ask both what is great about them, what is exciting about them, but also what are their limits. What do we learn in both terms that are inspirational, but also their limits, so we can ask the questions that Kyler really wanted to end with is, if the working class is going to be made into a class, if it's going to develop into a class, unions aren't a good institution for doing that. Unions are a good institution for resisting, for representing some workers. At their best, maybe there'll be moments when there is some terrific solidarity. That's not what unions do. And it's not even clear that unions can be renewed even to do that well, which they're not doing well now, without the existence of a party of some kind that has its feet in the community, it has its feet in different unions. And so it's consciously thinking not just about what are you going to do in this round of negotiations? Well, your options are lousy, so you'll do the best you can. But it's actually thinking about the long term so you can change the options. And that means thinking politically and having the kind of a party that is doing that. Now, we don't have an example of a party that can do that. We have to invent this. And either we run away from it or we confront it. But believing that the working class, if you just get rid of the bureaucrats and let them do their own thing, will magically know how to make a revolution is a detour, I guess, as Greg is starting to write an article about. So you know, this question of spontaneity, it's wonderful when it happens. And you always have to depend on the degree of spontaneity, but spontaneity isn't the answer.